With Smaug vanquished, Erebor and Dale restored, and Dol Guldur abandoned, a new era of peace for Middle-earth seems to have arrived. However, loose ends abound, as Gollum begins his desperate search for the precious, and Sauron begins to execute his master plan to utterly destroy Gondor and unleash his cruel tyranny upon all of Middle-earth. Join us as we continue our journey through the history of Middle-earth's Third Age. The Tolkien Road, Episode 209, The Lord of the Rings, History of the Third Age, Part 7. Hello everyone, welcome to The Tolkien Road, Episode 209. On this episode, we'll be continuing our journey through the history of the Third Age as we look at key events from the years 2942 through 3017, which are the years between Bilbo's journey to Erebor and Frodo's journey to Mordor.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds
I'd
good.
Say so.
Sounds real good.
Glad you agree.
Yes, I do.
Party on. Greta, how you doing?
I'm great. I was just about to ask you the same question.
I'm doing pretty well.
Good.
Doing pretty swell.
Doing good. Excited about the start of fall?
Yes, I am. Yeah, the weather here in Middle Tennessee is ideal.
It's lovely.
Today.
It's lovely.
Yes.
Perfect running weather.
So, I'm loving it like a McDonald's commercial. I'm loving it.
I'm loving it.
That's right.
Yes.
I just banked like $50,000 from McDonald's right there.
If only they were one of our sponsors.
All right. Yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Tolkien Road. And we got a good one coming up for you today. Continuing, nearing the end of our journey through the history of the Third Age with this episode, we're going to do, you know, we're going to do kind of a bonus one on this theme, which goes into the Fourth Age, and that'll be the next episode. But, you know, we're trying to cover all that timeline from the Lord of the Rings and all those events that, you know, you probably don't know a whole lot about. And I feel like, you know, what we're doing with this, Greta, is we're setting the stage for really, you know, the future of this podcast. And I think what we're going to be doing a lot of is diving deep into the lore and all of its various aspects, right? So, you know, the first 200 episodes we did, you know, really spent most of our time doing, focusing on the books, right? The major works of Middle Earth and doing a chapter by chapter read through of those. And, you know, now just doing and preparing for all these episodes, I realized just how much lore there is to explore, like how much background information.
It's so deep.
I feel like it's kind of, it's enough for many, many, many more years of episodes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It's no end in sight.
Absolutely. So I'm very excited about that. Well, we want to start off, as we always do, by giving a shout out to our patrons, to those who support us financially over on Patreon. Especially a shout out to our newest patrons, Todd G. and Dustin Q. Thank you to you both.
Thanks, guys.
For your patronage, for signing up to become patrons. If you would like to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/Tolkien Road to learn more, right? Mm-hmm. Get some awesome perks when you do so. And we just kind of started to revamp everything over there, so you can go over there and check it out. And you can know that when you contribute to the Tolkien Road in this way, you know, you're really keeping us going and keeping us moving in the right direction, which is to keep delivering on the weekly episodes and to really start to do more, right? Which is which is kind of the goal that I'm trying to build over there, right? I'm trying to build towards is really make this something where we continue doing the weekly, you know, the weekly podcast. But also, I'm able to do more in the world of videos, writings, books, all of those sorts of things. So,
yeah, multimedia.
Absolutely, absolutely, and all very much focused on the works of J.R.R. Tolkien.
Always.
So,
yeah,
that's what we're all about over here. So,
sounds great.
Become a patron today. You know,
help support the mission.
Support the mission. Get in on the ground floor. You know. Get in while the getting's good.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah.
All right. And if you're unable to support us via Patreon, you can also support us via Tip Jar, right? Which is where you leave a tip for a specific episode, right? Of any dollar amount you so choose. You can also subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. So please leave us a 5-star rating and say some nice things about us over on the over on iTunes and wherever it is you listen to podcasts. Yeah, that's what we need you to do.
Yep.
Subscribe, rate, review at the very least. At the very least.
Right. Yes. Right? Please. Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Still things pretty quiet in the world of Tolkien news. Send us tips if you see anything cool. Correspondence. We'll have a couple of things at the end of the episode. And I think that about covers the front matter for this episode.
Greta. Oh, yeah. All righty. Well, all that right. was quite efficient.
So let's do this.
Let's do it. On this episode, we're discussing the events spanning Third Age 2942 to Third Age 3017. With Erebor restored, things are looking up for the free peoples of Middle-earth for the first time in many years. Yet even with Sauron having abandoned Dol Guldur, he begins to execute his master plan to utterly destroy Gondor and unleash his cruel tyranny upon all of Middle-earth. Just when we thought things were all hunky-dory.
Yeah. Not so much.
Not so much.
So, right, on the last episode, we left off with the events of The Hobbit in 2941, and now we're going to cover those years that that span between between the events of The Hobbit in 2941 to what are called the Great Years here, which is 3018 and after for a few years. So 2942 through 3017, roughly a 75-year period. So
that's a lot less time than we've been covering.
It is. Well, there's a lot more events that are being called out because we obviously know much more about the events, you know, of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, and Tolkien would have had to go into much more detail about the things that happened between the two, right? Because The Lord of the Rings is such a detailed work.
Mm-hmm.
So
for sure.
Okay, so 2942, Sauron returned in secret to Mordor, right? He had been expelled from Dol Guldur in 2941 by Gandalf, working behind the scenes in The Hobbit. So, and then Bilbo returns to the Shire with the ring, of course, right? So Bilbo now has possession of the ring. He had gained it from Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
2944, Bard rebuilds Dale and becomes king. Gollum leaves the mountains and begins his search for the thief of the ring. Surprised it took Gollum 3 years to leave.
Yeah, that is a little strange. I wonder why.
What was he doing? Just like crying, you know,
He was probably worn out.
Maybe.
I mean, he'd been through a lot. But 3 years, that's a long time to just kind of rest.
Well, especially since he's like, the ring is the most important thing to him. You'd think he would be hot on Bilbo's trail.
Yeah, I know. It kind of makes me think he was like detained or something. Like he couldn't leave.
I don't know.
I don't know by what or who, but yeah.
Well, there were there were all those orcs in the Misty Mountains,
well,
of course, near where he lived. So maybe it was hard for him to escape. You know, maybe he was scared of trying to escape. And, you know, he'd also been living underground for, I think, centuries now.
Time.
Right? So he probably didn't want any part of the sun. So maybe it just took that long for the hunger for the ring to, you know, to overcome his fear of the sun, his hatred and fear of the sun and everything
that
outside.
That could very well be.
So.
And as long as, I mean, how old is he now? Like, he's old.
Yeah.
So 3 years, not that long, probably.
He's like 400 years old, right?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, what's 3 years when you're already 400, right? Like, I can wait 3 years.
Yeah, he would have been... 2463 was when he murdered Daigle. So he would be...
Oh, yeah. He's easily 400 years old.
Yeah, almost... Maybe almost 500 years old
right.
at this point.
Right, so. Yeah. So 3 years is nothing. Nothing to him.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Of course, Dale is the city of... The city of men right to the south of Erebor, right? So
that
Bard is...
Smaug destroyed, right?
Right,
and so Bard rebuilds it.
Yeah, and Bard the Bowman, of course, the one who killed Smaug.
Right, responsible for killing Smaug, yep.
Mm-hmm. 2948, Theoden, son of Thingol, king of Rohan, born. So, yeah, the birth of Theoden, who we know from Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
2949, Gandalf and Balin visit Bilbo in the Shire. This is, of course, actually in the last chapter, right, of The Hobbit when they visit. So, technically, The Hobbit happens from 2941 to 2949.
Okay. They just skip a few years.
Well, yeah, it's just, it's kind of an epilogue, like, almost.
Right, yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's not really much important in the way of plot that happens in that last, last chapter. So, 2950, Finduilas, daughter of Adrahil of Dol Amroth, born.
Why is that important?
So,
I'd never heard of her before.
I don't know that I had either, or I didn't remember. So, Finduilas is she'll become the wife of Denethor, right? The steward of Gondor, and so she's the mother of Boromir and Faramir.
Gotcha. That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
So she belongs in here. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. She's definitely worthy of mentioning.
I wasn't saying she didn't belong. I was just saying I didn't know who she was, and so I was wondering why she was mentioned. That's
yeah.
all. And, that makes sense now.
And by the way, Dol Amroth, this is something that's mentioned, like the Prince of Dol Amroth is mentioned in Lord of the Rings several times. Dol Amroth was a promontory ruled as a hereditary princedom situated on a peninsula in Gondor facing the Bay of Belfalas. So it's kind of it's part of Gondor, and it's, I believe it's like out in this region right here, and like this little island, or not island, but little like peninsula tip mm-hmm. over here to the, in the like southwestern part of Gondor. So,
cool.
Yeah, it's interesting that they had their princes and then they had the steward of Gondor, you know.
Yeah, that is interesting.
You almost wonder why they didn't just make the prince of, you know, the princes of Dol Amroth didn't just like become the kings when the last king of Gondor died. But
yeah, that is odd. It's almost like maybe one is more of like a figurehead. And the other are the actual ruling
mm-hmm.
body.
Yeah.
You know, like in Great Britain, you have the monarchy, the queen, who's kind of the figurehead, and then you have the parliament that actually does the ruling.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But it's just like if you don't have an heir in direct descent in these sorts of things, then you're going to go find somebody that's like a cousin, right? Or a distant relative, right? You know, there always seems to be like the succession, like who's third in line, who's fourth in line, who's fifth in line, mm-hmm. who's sixth in line, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right, so, right, yeah. Lots of fallbacks.
Yeah. Maybe they didn't have it written out enough, and so they couldn't, you know, they couldn't come up with a good plan for it. All right. Let's see. Yeah, so that's Finduilas, 2950. 2951, Sauron declares himself openly and gathers power in Mordor. He begins the rebuilding of Barad-dûr. Gollum turns towards Mordor. Sauron sends three of the Nazgûl to reoccupy Dol Guldur. All right, so he hadn't been away from Dol Guldur for too long, and he sends three Nazgûl to reoccupy it, and Sauron declares himself openly, right? So it's no secret in 2951 that Sauron is out, and he means business.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's back, and he means business. As if...
And not good business.
No.
Mm-mm.
Well, Sauron doesn't ever really mean good business.
Never.
So... All right. Elrond, also in this year, Elrond reveals to Estelle, Aragorn, his true name and ancestry, and delivers to him the shards of Narsil. Arwen, newly returned from Lorien, meets Aragorn in the woods of Imladris. Aragorn goes out into the wild. 2953, the last meeting of the White Council, they debate the rings. Saruman feigns that he has discovered that the One Ring has passed down Anduin to the sea. Saruman withdraws to Isengard, which he takes as his own, and fortifies it. Being jealous and afraid of Gandalf, he sets spies to watch all his movements and notes his interest in the Shire. He soon begins to keep agents in Bree and the South Farthing. So, yeah, last meeting of the White Council, you know, and we're still a good ways out, right, from the events of the Lord of the Rings. So, unfortunately, because Sauron has gotten, you know, all devious and plotting, it seems like, you know, the alliance, or the this White Council, which maybe had been doing some good and holding Sauron in check, they don't meet again, right? So that obviously hurts the cause against Sauron. Let's see, 2954, Mount Doom bursts into flame again. So one thing that interested me, and I looked this up, was where did Mount Doom come from, right? And it turns out, according to this article here on Tolkien Gateway, Melkor created Mount Doom in the First Age, and the name Mordor may have been given to the surrounding land before Sauron settled there because of its eruptions. So apparently, that is a reference to one of the volumes of the History of Middle-earth, the Peoples of Middle-earth, actually, which I have not read that before, so I'm interested to go check that out and learn more about this idea. But apparently, Mount Doom was created by Melkor and has been around since the First Age.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Cool little bit of ancient lore there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe explains why Mount Doom was such a powerful, you know, why its fires were so powerful, right?
And why that was the only place that the One Ring could be destroyed.
Well, yeah, and it had forged the One Ring, and that it was the only place it could be destroyed, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So that would, to just be able to forge that, they would have to be pretty powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, well, it makes sense then. Melkor was its, you know, was the magic behind it.
And what do you know, 2954, there's still some people living in Ithilien at that time, and they leave. They're like, done here, fleeing over the Anduin, back to safer areas.
I thought they had already all departed.
Well, maybe it was just like, you know, just some last, like, you know, stragglers, right? You know, there's always those people, right, who are like, I ain't leaving until, you know, I'll leave when I die or something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they, some of the neighbors saw some of the other neighbors actually die and were like, okay, maybe I don't want to die, right? So.
Yeah. That could be. I'm wondering about, I'm sorry, I'm going back a little bit.
You're good.
But I'm wondering about this meeting between mm-hmm. Aragorn and Arwen. So prior to this, he was living with Elrond.
Yep.
And he didn't. So his dad died. So when did Elrond take him in? He took him in 2933.
Yep.
And now this is 2951.
Mm-hmm.
Do the math for me. I'm bad at 18. Math. He's 18.
Well, he would be.
Well,
he'd
be
20.
20. Okay, so yeah. He's 20 when Elrond reveals the truth to him.
Right.
I don't know. There's something about this, and I know that it goes into more depth than Lord of the Rings, but it just seems like this is obviously more than a chance meeting here mm-hmm. between Arwen and Aragorn.
Right.
But it's perplexing to me why Aragorn goes out into the wild. Is he upset that he didn't find out about his true ancestry until he was 20? Or is he just tired of living with Elrond and he wants to go be a ranger? Do you know what I'm saying?
I mean, we don't really get an indication of that. Maybe he's, I mean, he's, you know, the Dúnedain are rangers, right? In the north, they're rangers, so
it's in his blood to want to.
Well, I don't know if you can say it's in his blood, but it's maybe his job, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. There's just something about these events that are, I don't know.
Hmm.
I don't know that they're necessarily bothering me, but they're making me think a little bit.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay, well.
All right. For what it's worth.
Fair enough.
Okay.
It's good to make you think.
Yeah, and it's interesting, but it's also interesting to me that that happens the same year
mm-hmm.
that, like, Sauron openly declares himself.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
It's that the same year that Sauron declares himself, Aragorn finds out his true lineage.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that's an interesting connection that it happens in the same year.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole thing of Sauron openly declaring himself, like, that in and of itself, that idea interests me. Like, what does that mean exactly? Like, did he, like, send out heralds to all the lands and, like, hear ye,
right.
Sauron has returned, he's gonna kick your bleeps,
I hereby
right?
declare yeah. that I am evil and I am out to destroy you.
Yeah. I know you didn't really think I was Sauron, but I am. Surprise!
I know I had you fooled
right.
for a little while.
Anybody seen my ring, by the way?
Maybe this is like the good that's kind of trying to cancel out the bad. Because you have all this terrible stuff of Sauron declaring himself, and then Gollum turning toward Mordor, and then the Nazgul reoccupying Dúguldor. But then in that same year, you have the meeting, you have Aragorn finding out his true heritage, you have Arwen and Aragorn meeting, and then, you know, like,
yeah.
it's like, it's the flip side.
Mm-hmm.
of the bad.
Okay.
It's the good balancing out the bad. It's the hope come shining into the darkness, even though nobody realizes it for what it is.
I see what you're saying. Yep. I see what you're getting at.
Okay. All right. We can move on now.
Okay. It was good stuff. Yeah. 2956, Aragorn meets Gandalf and their friendship begins. And then this is a interesting little juicy little tidbit here. 2957 through 80, Aragorn undertakes his great journeys and errantries. As Thorungil, he deserves in disguise both Thingol of Rohan and Ecthelion II of Gondor.
Oh.
So I love the fact that there's this like 23-year period where he's just off on all these like great adventures, right? So I remember that when the Lord of the Rings, when Letron Prime was first announced, that the rumor was that it was going to be about Aragorn. And I wonder if this was like kind of what they were going to base it in, right? You know, this period of 23 years where he's out doing these great journeys and errantries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
what is an errantry? Is that like just a fancy errand?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, do missions.
Next time I say I'm going out, I'm not going to say I'm going out to run errands. I'm going out on errantries.
Yes.
Yep.
Errantries.
Sounds much more exciting.
Yeah, it would get kind of boring after, you know, a couple of times, though. Unless you say, like, errantries.
I'm going out on errantries.
So he's this name Thorungil. You might be wondering what it means, Greta.
Actually, I was.
Thorungil means Eagle of the Star.
Oh.
Eagle of the Star, so...
So that's the name he takes.
Yeah, one of many names. One of many names of Aragorn.
The Eagle of the Stars.
Yes.
I like that.
2968, The Birth of Frodo.
Mm.
All right, big deal.
Mm-hmm.
2976, Denethor weds Finduilas of Dol Amroth. So, let's see, Finduilas would have been... How old? She would have been 26. So she's a you know, she's a little older.
Basically an old maid.
Okay. I mean, according to the standards of this time.
Well, that's what it meant. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. 2977, Bane, son of Bard, becomes king of Dale. I'm assuming Bard had passed away. 2978, birth of Boromir, son of Denethor II.
Okay.
We know Boromir. 29. That so that means he would have been 40 in the Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Right.
Boromir would have been.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aragorn enters Lorien and there meets again Arwen Undumiel. Aragorn gives her the ring of Barahir and they plight their troth upon the hill of Cairn Amroth. About this time, Gollum reaches the confines of Mordor and becomes acquainted with Shelob. Theoden becomes king of Rohan, birth of Samwise. So Sam is 28, or 38 in Lord of the Rings. Now... This
so
ring,
Samwise and Faramir are the same age.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
This ring of Barahir. Ring of Barahir. So, do you remember what the ring of Barahir was?
Nope.
All right, going back to the first age, right? Barahir was the father of Beren, right? And Barahir had basically saved the life of Finrod Felagund, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he had saved the life of Finrod Felagund. I believe it was in the Battle of Sudden Flame. And so this was an heirloom that had been passed down through all of these, you know, through all of these ages. And I guess it stayed in the possession of the, you know, the line of the... It's interesting. I'm not sure who would have stayed in the line of possession, how it exactly got passed down to Aragorn. But I don't know if it was an heirloom of the kings of Numenor or if it was some other line. But here Aragorn has it, right? Aragorn has it all these years later and he gives it to Arwen, right?
It's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's not like just giving someone your letter jacket or class ring. I mean, this is serious.
Yeah.
So you could say things are getting pretty serious.
I guess you could say things are getting pretty serious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's see. Cairn Amroth. Cairn Amroth was a mound in the heart of the ancient land of Lothlorien in which two rings of trees and a great tree with a white flet. So this is in Lothlorien.
And that's where they... talking about. They pledge their love.
Yes.
For one another.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
About this time, Gollum reaches the confines of Mordor and becomes acquainted with Shelob. Theoden becomes king of Rohan, birth of Samwise. So pretty eventful year there, 2980.
That's interesting, because mine says 2983 is when Faramir and Samwise are born.
I would say mine's probably correct, right? Based
probably.
On what we saw before.
Yep, probably. So, I mean, it is just a 3-year difference, so.
Yeah, and I've got, like, the Kindle version, so it might get updated.
Get updated, yeah.
You know, when there's new little corrections that are, when there's revisions that are issued.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, according to Tolkien Gateway, he was published in, or he was published. He was born in 2980. It says, in the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, Sam's year of birth was added to the Tale of Years. It was, however, third age, 2983. This contradicts both the long father tree of Master Samwise and a later entry in the Tale of Years. The incorrect date has been corrected in the 50th anniversary edition.
Ah, so there you go.
Mm-hmm.
It all makes sense now.
Yeah. So Faramir would have been 35 at the time of Lord of the Rings. So 2984, death of Ecthelion II, Denethor becomes the steward of Gondor. 2988, Finduilas dies young.
Yeah, what she would died have of. Been young.
Yeah.
She would have been...
Which may go some, you know, to explain somewhat why she,
38.
Denethor was so miserable all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see. This is actually Finduilas of the... First Age, who is an Noldoran princess. Let's look for Finduilas, the wife of Denethor. There we go. Yeah, so... do we have anything
of her
death? It just
says her health dwindled in the
city. Yeah, her health dwindled, okay. Right.
Yeah, so she must have just not had a very strong constitution.
Well, and that kind of explains, too, Denethor's attitude towards Faramir, because it sounds like Faramir maybe... You know, the birth of Faramir maybe weakened her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, caused a her premature death. Even though she died 5 years after the birth of Faramir, you know, you've maybe heard this story before where, you know, one of the spouse blames the most recent child for the death of the...
For the
death
mother.
Of the mother,
mm-hmm.
right? The
mm-hmm.
the husband. Yeah.
yeah.
So, there you go, right? Finduilas, and that's maybe why that's a little bit relevant to this story.
Mm.
2989, Balin leaves Erebor and enters Moria. So Balin is trying to see if, now that Erebor is reestablished, maybe, just maybe, we can finally reestablish Khazad-dûm after this 1,000 years of exile from it, right? From our ancestral home. 2991, Éomer, Éomer's son, born in Rohan, right? We know Éomer from the from Lord of the Rings, of course. Nephew of Theoden.
Mm-hmm.
2994, Balin perishes and the dwarf colony is destroyed. So much for the return to Khazad-dûm. Yeah, unfortunately, didn't last very long. Now, why did Balin perish? So, Balin... Let's see here... Ah, yes. For 5 years, the colony thrived. They managed to find many old treasures, mithril, and armories. But on 10 November 2994, as Balin went to look in Miromir, an orc archer fatally shot him. Balin's body was placed in a tomb in the chamber of Mazarbul. And after a fierce battle in the halls and a final stand in the chamber of Mazarbul, the colony was completely wiped out. So, yeah. Only 5 years of the new Khazad-dûm, and then it's gone, and that's of course what we see. So this had all happened 24 years before we come to Moria and come to the Chamber of Mazarbul in Lord of the Rings, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we find it desolate and all these, you know, dead dwarves and, you know, this sort of thing. 24 years just lying in there. So 2995, Éowyn, the sister of Éomer, is born. So she's 23 when Lord of the Rings happens. Around 3000, the Shadow of Mordor lengthens. Sauron dares to use the Palantir of Orthanc, but becomes ensnared by Sauron's Sea. So he hadn't really started using that Palantir until now, right?
Okay.
And Sauron has the Ithil Stone, right? He becomes a traitor to the Council. His spies report that the Shire is being closely guarded by the Rangers. So
he's really he doesn't become a servant of Sauron until around 3000.
Well, and there's still, it's in the book, it's much more of a gray thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is he,
it's like a slow descent.
Well, and also it's never like in the movie they make it seem much more like he's like, you know, become this vassal of Sauron and he's like pledged his loyalty to Sauron, right?
Right, right, right.
In the book, it's much more open-ended, right? Like, is he actually a servant of Sauron? And that's why I was talking about earlier. Like, he's Saruman is a, you know, he's an opportunist, right? He is mm-hmm. he's going to do what's ever best for Saruman in any particular situation, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
So if he feels that Sauron might win, then he might end up serving Sauron.
Mm.
If he thinks he could beat Sauron, of course he'd like to beat Sauron, right? So. There is no, Saruman doesn't seem like he's, like, sold out and loyal to Sauron.
Right. He's only loyal to himself.
Right.
And to ultimately whatever party to at the time is going to help him.
Going to benefit him. That's correct.
Gotcha. Yeah.
3001, Bilbo's farewell feast. So, of course, this is where we come to the beginning of Lord of the Rings. And but it's only 17 years before the journey of Frodo, begins. So... You know, we still have some events that happen between this and the, you know, kind of the major portion of Lord of the Rings. Gandalf suspects his ring to be the One Ring. The guard in the Shire is doubled. Gandalf seeks for news of Gollum and calls on the help of Aragorn. So, apparently, the guard in the Shire would probably refer to the guard of the Rangers, right? So, the Rangers...
Right, because that's mentioned in 3000, is that Saruman reports that the Shire is being closely guarded by the Rangers.
Right.
Is that because the ring is there? Why are the Rangers guarding the Shire at this point?
I think because there's all this interest in... there's this interest in the Shire, right? So they go into this in Lord of the Rings. I think Gandalf explains this in Lord of the Rings. But I think by this time, Sauron's figured out that, oh, a hobbit or one of these little halflings probably got hold of the ring in the Gladden Fields. And where do halflings live now? Right?
I see.
So there's a lot of interest in this region.
So, okay, that makes sense. So they don't know for sure that this is where the ring is. It's just a strong suspicion.
That's right.
At this point. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, 3002, Bilbo becomes a guest of Elrond and settles in Rivendell. 3004, Gandalf visits Frodo in the Shire and does so at intervals during the next 4 years. 3007, Bran, son of Bane, becomes king in Dale, death of Gilrion, of course, Aragorn's mother. 3008, in the autumn, Gandalf pays his last visit to Frodo. By the way, Gilrion would have been how old? She would have been...
I don't remember when she was born.
2907, so she would have been... about 100 years old.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
100 years old. Of course, I think she would have been one of these, you know, Numenoreans with a longer lifespan. So, that might, you know, 100 years is pretty darn good.
Yeah,
for back,
absolutely.
You know, thinking back then, so.
Yeah.
All right. 3008 in the autumn. We said Gandalf pays his last visit to Frodo. So by the time Lord of the Rings rolls around, Frodo hasn't seen Gandalf for 10 years.
Hmm.
In 3009, Gandalf and Aragorn renew their hunt for Gollum at intervals during the next 8 years, searching in the vales of Anduin, Mirkwood, and Rhovanion to the confines of Mordor. At some time during these years, Gollum himself ventured into Mordor and was captured by Sauron. Elrond sends for Arwen, and she returns to Imladris. The mountains and all lands eastward are becoming dangerous. And then 3017, Gollum is released from Mordor. He is taken by Aragorn in the Dead Marshes and brought to Thranduil in Mirkwood. Gandalf visits Minas Tirith and reads the Scroll of Isildur.
So that's still prior to the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and then 3018 is when Lord of the Rings... Well, no, Lord of the Rings begins in 3001, right? But then there's a 17-year gap basically between Chapter 1 and Chapter 2, right?
Gotcha. Yes.
Yeah, so
that makes sense. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, cool. So that gets us to Lord of the Rings, right?
Yes, it does.
Which we assume by now you know the plot of. And if you don't, you need to go read it and listen to the episodes we did on it.
Yeah.
And then next time we'll take a look at the timeline events after Lord of the Rings.
Cool.
Yeah.
That sounds fun.
Sounds good?
Yeah. Perfect.
All right. What are we doing? Yeah, correspondence. Yeah. So a couple of pieces of correspondence we want to share with you guys this week.
Sweet.
First off is from Who is it from?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. It's from Joey.
Joey.
Joey, one of our amazing patrons. Joey, on August 28th, left a comment on, let's see, where was it? Pulling up the wrong ones here.
Come on, dude.
I'm sorry.
Get it together.
All right. Here we go. Oh, this is on Akalabeth Part 2. This is back from episode 77 that he left this comment on. So we're talking about the downfall of Numenor here. Joey says, "The latter half of this story always spells out one thing when I read it, pride. It is the root of all evil, and with it comes destruction. It shows the depravity of man and the weakness that comes through the flesh. Numenor is the perfect example of what occurred in the Garden of Eden. You have bliss and paradise in the beginning, followed by discord through the serpent, Sauron, coming to disregard the rightful authority and whisper lies. Wanting power and eternal life that is not within their rights is that downward spiral of arrogance and greed seen here. Ultimately, it is their downfall and undoing. Eru intervenes and swallows Numenor up in the sea. This correlates to me of the fall of man and sin entering the world. Man is no longer allowed to stay in the garden because of their sin and can never have that perfect peace and balance again with God. Their pride was their own ruin. They had everything they needed and wanted, a gift freely given to men, but it wasn't enough for them. You see this theme constant throughout the history of Middle-earth, stories of sin, redemption, restoration, and sometimes ultimate destruction." Yeah, so thanks,
yeah,
Joey.
That's really good.
Definitely some very, you know, strong parallels between the, you know, between the first few chapters of Scripture and with the story of the downfall of Numenor.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, if we could hear Tolkien comment on this, I think he would probably acknowledge that there are those strong parallels do exist. Not that he was, you know, as we always do want to say, not that he was necessarily trying to write something that was allegorical or intentionally, you know, meant to parallel the story of the fall from the Bible, but nevertheless, you know, you definitely have a very similar pattern, right? And that theme of like Sauron corrupting and like kind of teaching the people of Numenor, like not to, you know, not to disregard the like authority of the Valar, or to like, you know, believe, kind of like twisting around to believing that they're like benevolent, to being malevolent, right? That they're, mm-hmm. they're these malevolent forces that want to keep, you know, they want to keep the Numenoreans from eternal life, right? Mm-hmm. They want to keep them from having that, you know, that immortality. Right.
Right.
And
yeah. Well, it's just that whole scheme of manipulation.
Right.
That evil often, that's how it weaves its way in.
Mm-hmm.
Is by those manipulative ways.
Yeah, and just one of those, another reason that makes me very excited for, you know, the for Lord of the Rings on Prime. And the yes. exploration of the Second Age.
Yeah.
You know.
And that's gonna focus on Numenor.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, so
good.
It's I'm just very hopeful that, you know, they're going to I really hope that they get kind of this, that this is one of the stronger themes of that show, right? That mm-hmm. there's this yeah. idea that I guess what I'm trying to say is I hope they don't try to do anything that's like more of a modern twist on the story where they try to make it like are the Ainur, you know, really good. Now, I'm not saying that it's not open for discussion of like what goodness actually looks like, but I think being true to Tolkien is acknowledging that like he would have said yes, like you know, the Valar and the Maiar and the people of Valinor are definitely a, you know, a force and the force for good in this world, right? And in the world of his creation, and Sauron was a corrupting force. And if you kind of, you know, if it becomes this kind of wishy-washy relativistic thing, I think it's gonna hurt it. You know,
for sure.
You know, it's kind of like that idea of like, well, what if, you know, what if Sauron was really the good guy, right? And it's like, no, you misunderstand. Like Sauron wants you to think he's the good guy, right? But he's not the good guy. That's how he operates, right? He wants you to think he's the good guy,
mm-hmm.
like Melkor did, right? Like mm-hmm. Melkor did right before he struck down the two trees, right?
A sheep in wolf's clothing.
Exactly.
No, a wolf in sheep's clothing.
A wolf in sheep's clothing.
I
that's
got it
right.
Backwards.
Or a wolf in shepherd's clothing. even.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
A wolf in shepherd's clothing, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So anyway, great note, Joey, and always wonderful to hear from you. And then our other piece of correspondence for this week is from Marilyn.
Marilyn
librarian. Marilyn says on September 10th, and this was in response to another letter of hers, as you know, we kind of have this running dialogue with Marilyn on a couple of different threads, and because she writes such good correspondence. And we had been talking about, I think I'd asked a few questions about some points she made about the Istari.
Yes.
The wizards. And I was confused about her saying that Gandalf is Manwë's Maia and Radagast is Yavanna's. And then Marilyn, I realized, like, as soon as we published that episode, I kind of thought about it more and I went back and actually read Unfinished Tales and, you know, that part from Unfinished Tales again. And then I found it. I'd forgotten how long that chapter actually is and that there's actually kind of several parts to it. And I know there's... so anyway, let me read Marilyn's letter. She said, "You asked for my sources on the Istari and the Silmarillion. The paragraph on Gandalf says, wisest of the Maia was Elorin. He too dwelt in Lorien, but his ways took him often to the house of Nienna, and of her he learned pity and patience. So no connection with Yavanna, though an interesting link there, perhaps, with Galadriel, as she also spent time in Lorien and got to know Melian there as well, I'm guessing, as in Doriath. For a while now, I've been thinking about Nienna. She is too often overlooked and, to my mind, undervalued. I think I may try to write something about her one day. For the rest, page 393 of Unfinished Tales has the most detail of the council in which Manwë asked for 3 volunteers to go as emissaries to Middle-earth. So Aule chose Kurumo, and Orome sent Alatar, one of the Blue Wizards. It suddenly occurs to me that being chosen and sent by Valar isn't exactly free will. It was Manwë who called forth Olorin, who had arrived late. Olorin asked what Manwë wished of him, and when told, he claimed he was too weak to contest with Sauron, whom he feared. Manwë said that was all the more reason why Olorin should go and commanded him to go. Again, And Varda said something to the effect that Olorin would not be going as the third, and Kurumo remembered it. Poor Kurumo. He had to be best or nothing, not unlike Denethor. The dangers of pride and power, indeed." So again, that theme of pride right there that Joey brought up, right?
Yep, there it is.
Yeah, good points, Marilyn. And, you know, thank you for kind of guiding us on understanding where they came from. Again, it had been a long time since I'd read that portion from Unfinished Tales. And so it's helpful for me to refresh on, you know, who particular Maia were aligned with. And I'd forgotten about it, talking about it in Valaquenta as well. So, very good stuff. And let's see, there was something else I wanted to say. Oh, yeah, the comments on free will. Free will is such a tricky concept. It's such a tricky philosophical concept. And, you know, like I believe in free will. But it's funny, as a Catholic, you believe in free will and in predestination, right? You kind of hold both in tension, right? Both of them exist in the catechism of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's almost like they're kind of different sides of the same coin, right?
Yeah.
But even in free will and kind of like, is free will absolute will, right? Is it ever like an absolute will kind of thing? Like, because even as you know, if we kind of hold a robust view of free will, of human free will, for example, like we also acknowledge that like there's certain, like there's the context into which we're born dictates something of how free we truly are. Right. So, you know, if I'm born with, you know, some kind of condition that prevents me from walking, I'm not free to walk. Right.
Right.
You know, if I'm born with a, you know, some kind of thing that makes me more prone to having some kind of, you know, some kind of vice or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Some kind of genetic thing that makes me more prone to having some kind of vice, right? Mm-hmm. How truly free am
right.
I, right?
Yeah. No, it's
So free will is something we hold as a reality, right? And I think it's hard to deny it, but it's mixed in with factors that are outside of your freedom. Right, to control.
Right, outside of our choosing. Right. And I think the distinction that needs to be made here is that free will, at least to me anyway, it basically debunks the idea that there's someone up there pulling strings and that we're just like puppets, right? Yes. Like, that's the thing, is we are not, we're not controlled in every sense of the word. Mm-hmm. Like, we have the ability and the freedom to make our own choices, but like you said, there are constraints on that,
mm-hmm.
you know, within and without, for everybody.
Yeah.
So, so I think it's more of a distinction between extremes that needs to be made.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, but.
Right. And there's also the question of freedom. Freedom, you know, freedom is a choice, you know, freedom is the ability to choose between two things or three things or four things. But the reality that based on your choice, you might actually limit your freedom, limit your future ability to have free will.
Right.
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 You might circumscribe
mm-hmm.
it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
The example of an addict, right, is the good example mm-hmm. of that. Right. You know, you're free. You know, you're free in a very kind of absolute sense, I guess you could say, to go out and, you know, buy a very addictive drug and use it.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
But that limits your freedom. that limits
right.
your future
By
freedom
that,
to reject
it,
right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah, anyway, and I'm not sure actually this is exactly what Marilyn was talking about in this context. I think she was referring more to like the order given, right? Which gets into the whole, that kind of goes back to the discussion we were having with Marilyn on like hierarchies and that kind of
yes.
thing. And,
yeah.
And the idea that like, you know, what was Gandalf, was Alorin, free to say no to Manwë?
Right. And that's kind of what was the thought that yeah. was going through my brain is, you know, I think what Marilyn says here is, it suddenly occurs to me that being chosen and sent by Valar isn't exactly free will.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you could say, well, did they have the freedom to say no? To say, no, I'm not going to go.
Right.
You know, you can't say no to being chosen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people are chosen for different things all the time.
Right.
But I think there's still an aspect of free will there that can be exercised to mm-hmm. say, no, I'm not going to do this.
Yeah. I don't know that necessarily that he couldn't have said no. Right. Now, if he had said no, what would the consequences of that be?
Right. There's always right? consequences either way.
Would Manwë have just like zapped him out of existence or something like that? Or would Manwë have just been like, well, I guess I'll need to pick somebody else. Right.
Right.
It kind of reminds
right.
me of
yeah.
the, you know, the case, like in the case of a, you know, a person and, you know, like, we'll just say like a Congressional Medal of Honor winner. Right.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the classic kind of story of hero and a hero in combat who is in the middle of a, you know, is in like a hut, you know, a house or a hut somewhere, like, and surrounded on all sides, and a grenade gets thrown into the middle of the house. And this soldier is in there with his, several of his, compatriots, his comrades, right? His brothers in arms.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees it and chooses to throw himself upon the grenade to absorb its blast and save the lives of his comrades. Right.
Right.
And take the hit for the team. Right. Mm-hmm. As it were. Right.
Yeah.
A very incredibly heroic thing to do. Right.
Absolutely.
And, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Right. He could have chosen not to do that. And then they all, or some of them, would have died, or the consequences would have been different. But the consequences of not doing it would have been something that he would have had to live with for the rest of his life. Like his kind of the deaths of these other people, right? Kind of feeling like I could have stopped their deaths.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, that may seem like a very extreme example, but I think there's something in this where Alorin is like, you know, you have, yeah, what, you know, what does that free choice really look like, right? Is it kind of ideal situation where it's like one thing is, you know, it's like you're free to choose or you're free not to choose? And sometimes that is the reality. Like sometimes with our kids, it's like, look, you can choose this path or you can choose this path. Here's what I think you should do. But you've got to ultimately choose what you think is best based on all of the different, you know, based on all the different parameters. But sometimes because of the nature of the world, right, and the problems of the world, we don't always, like, it's not always going to be that easy a choice, like, you know, that feel like that free a choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I can just pick one or the other, and it's really kind of neutral, right? Sometimes it's like, you know, if you don't choose this path, Alorin, then, I mean, I can't force you to, ultimately, Manwë says, but this is the path that I see you called to, right?
Right.
This is the path that I see you called to. Mm-hmm. And I know you're afraid. Mm-hmm. I know you're afraid, like, you know, maybe like the soldiers storming Normandy were, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
But this is the path you are called to, and it's the path of heroism for you, right?
Right. And sometimes it takes someone that knows you
mm-hmm.
just as well, if not better, than you know yourself
to
direct you in that way. And I think it's worth, especially when you know, like if it's your parents, or like you said, if it's, you know, if it's Monway, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, if it's someone who you have respect for and know that they have your best interests at heart, it's worth listening to them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have a decent reason to say no, and you can make a good case for saying no or going against their recommendation, then, you know, that's where free will comes in. But there's also that freedom in consent as well. Mm-hmm. And there's a freedom in trusting those that know you and care about you and want to see the best for you. There's freedom in knowing that you can trust and that you should trust, and that it's not all on you to make those decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, well, at the end of the day, it's really interesting to think of Gandalf being, like, you know, afraid to go out on this mission, but he does anyway, which is...
Fear is not something you often... you often equate with Gandalf.
Right, but I think that's... I think Tolkien probably, you know, kind of worked that in that aspect into the story, because there's something... You know, even in the case of Frodo can choose not to take the ring.
He
can choose not to be the person. I don't think anyone was... I have to go back and read the Council of Elrond again, but, you know, I know there's this moment where he steps up and he's like, I will take it, though I do not know the way, right? Everybody mm-hmm. else is kind of arguing about who should do
mm-hmm.
it. And it becomes clear that, like, Frodo is kind of... This is his destiny.
Mm-hmm.
He can reject that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He can reject that and choose not to do it, ultimately. But it's his destiny to, like, enter into this path of difficulty and suffering for the sake of the rest of the world. Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's a very, it obviously is going to draw some parallels to, like, you know, to Christ and the Garden of Gethsemane and, you know, if this cup, you know,
can pass from my lips,
you know,
if there's another way,
mm-hmm. but not my will, but yours be done. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so again, like, it is when we call that a free choice, right? Whether it be Frodo, whether it be Gandalf, whether it be Christ, right? What does that actually mean, right? Like, mm-hmm. what is the freedom? What is the degree of freedom we're actually talking about, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a loaded...
But for a creative being, how can it ever be absolute freedom, right?
Yeah.
It can't be.
Not if you believe in a higher power.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
it can't be.
Because you're contingent, right? You are a being within the larger reality, right? You are a being within the larger reality. And so mm-hmm. It's not always going to be the ideal situation for you.
Right. Because the world doesn't revolve around you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting too. When you think about, you mentioned predestination earlier, you know, how that relationship between free will and predestination, as Catholics, we believe in both, which is, you know, a little mind-boggling, to say the least. But, you know, I mean, we believe that our path has been set for us,
mm-hmm.
and we can deviate from it because we have free will. We can choose to take the scenic route,
mm-hmm.
right? But our destination is still going to be our destination.
Mm-hmm.
We have a great friend who is a priest,
mm-hmm.
and he tells the story of how many times he tried to avoid the call to the mm-hmm. priesthood, and how many ways.
Yeah.
He took the scenic route to the priesthood, but he's now a priest.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I mean, he got there. So it's just, you know, it's just really interesting to think about, our destiny, you know, has been determined
mm-hmm.
already. But it is still up to us on how we're, you know, and how long and what way we're going to get there.
Good points. And a final thought on all of this. I feel like reconciling predestination and free will is a matter of understanding like the interplay of the two, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're ultimately talking about is the like kind of an ultimate will, and then the content, like kind of the wills of created beings, right, who have the ability to make like moral choices and that sort of thing, right? Reason and moral, they have the ability to reason, and then, you know, and then the ability to make moral choices. And but within the context of the overall like higher will, right, in this predestination question, it's almost like I think people run into errors when they try to emphasize one to the exclusion of the other completely.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
And but it's almost like predestination and free will have a mysterious interplay, right?
Yeah.
And in all of this, it kind of draws me back to the whole idea of subcreation, right? That like we are creating the final product in accordance with, accordance with God, right? Like that we are subcreators, right?
Subcreators, yes.
Subcreators mm-hmm. of the final reality, and that it all kind of we play our part in fashioning the world, just as the Valar, right? The Ainur and then the Valar mm-hmm. played their role in fashioning mm-hmm. Arda, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Great way to bring it back full circle.
Absolutely. Wow. Huge, fascinating topic. Thanks so much, Marilyn.
Yes.
Always good hearing from you.
Always.
Thanks for opening kind of up a can of worms that got us going on very deep philosophical topics.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, everybody. We would love to hear from you too. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com through the website, Facebook, Twitter, etc. Next episode will be the history. I think it'll be the last one on kind of this arc we've been on, and then we're going to dive into a bunch of other cool stuff after that. We'll probably talk more about that on the next episode. So, yeah, make sure you show up for that one.
Yeah.
All right, and special thanks once again to our patrons, especially the following: Shannon S.,
Brian O.,
Emilio P.,
Zeke F.,
James A.,
James L.,
Chris L.,
Chuck F.,
Asya V.,
Ish of the Hammer,
Teresa C.,
David of Pints with Jack,
Jonathan D.,
Eric S.,
Joey S.,
Eric B.,
Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien,
Matt L.,
Johanna T.,
and Todd G.
All right. Thank you so much, everybody, and we will talk at you next time.
Bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.